trip to examine this common basis of life, a voyage to investigate the molecular machinery at the heart of life on Earth.
All life is related, and it enables us to construct with confidence the complex tree that represents the history of life. The Earth is, as far as we know, unique in the universe. It contains life. Here, plants and animals proliferate in such numbers that we still have not even named all the different species. Darwin's great insight revolutionized the way in which we see the world. We now understand why there are so many different species.
Every cell is a triumph of natural selection, and we're made of trillions of cells. In us is a little universe. Those are some of the things that molecules do. Given 4 billion years of evolution, we are, each of us, a multitude.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your philosopher, political science guy, and this is a slimmed-down version of our regular broadcast. We have absence today, two of our free thinkers, Daniel, who's off with a cold, and Rob, who is, I think, skiing or something in the great beyond.
Yeah, he's off at the Alps or something like that, having a great time. Leaving us here to do our fun little radio show on our own.
Although we do have a little segment Rob recorded for us, just so that we get a little fix of Rob every episode.
Yeah. Do you remember how, like, you know, back a couple of months ago when, you know, Elon left and then Rob disappeared and Daniel stopped showing up and it was just the two of us and we...
You know, it's about time we got back to the fundamentals, the thing that makes this show really strong. Sorry, Rob or Daniel, if you're listening. We do miss you.
Yes, sort of. Well, we should start off, though, and let our listeners know that we had a bit of a hiccup last week. Technical problem here at CITR, and our show was not podcasted. Did go live if you listened. I hope you did. But unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to add our show to the everlasting internet.
Exactly. And we had a couple of subjects on there that we thought were quite noteworthy. We had a discussion with someone from the Skeptic Camp. I talk about the Pope and his involvement with pedophilia, and Coulter and free speech. And we thought, you know, because we have such a strong following in the podosphere, that we would revisit those particular topics on this particular show.
Consider the first one a trial run through. This will be for keeps this time.
Just to make Ethan's hair stand on end. I personally think this is a great test to show whether our first show podcast was destroyed by God or not. Because we were talking about the Pope, and, well, we're also talking about Ann Coulter, but I think the Pope might be stronger in this, and whether it was an act of God or not. So if this podcast also goes FUBAR, I might be a little worried.
Yeah, maybe a little. I don't know. I'll still keep my faith in the spaghetti monster, for the time being at least. Well, why don't we talk about some in-the-news items right off the bat? I actually read a really interesting article in the Globe and Mail about whether or not atheists have different brains than believers.
Well, we talked about this beforehand, and don't we all have our own brains? I mean, we don't share brains, do we?
Well, yes, but I think what they were going after is there a biological difference in the brain of an atheist versus the brain in a believer? Well, according to Jordan Gathman, a neurophysicist at the National Institute for Neurological Disorders, there is no, quote, God spot in the brain that lights up when religious people pray or meditate. It is therefore very likely that atheists are not missing some part of the brain that makes you religious.
Or religious people aren't missing some part of the brain that makes you rational.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is kind of another piece of evidence, and sort of a long line of evidence getting, that there is no God spot. For example, Phil Zuckerman, a sociologist at Pitzer College, points out that there are a few differences in sort of religious belief, but there's nothing biological. Well, possibly, he says. He points out that there's gender differences in religious belief, suggesting that men tend to be more atheistic than women.
Oh, is that cultural, though, that might be?
See, that's what I was kind of thinking. But I guess he's going with that, is that it could suggest there is a biological difference if men and women are naturally more believing or not believing. But again, I would sort of lend, well, that does seem to be cultural to me.
I remember watching a documentary with Richard Dawkins, and they were using what I'm going to call the magnetic effect, where they take a high-powered magnet to certain parts of the brain, where you get this sort of feeling of somebody's watching you. There's another presence in the room. Does this address that at all, or is this... Well, what was the actual methodology of this particular experiment, do you know?
Well, see, they didn't say. This was more... It almost came across like an opinion piece, but it was published in the Science section, which, I mean, maybe says something about the Globe and Mail. But the study, or the article did mention a few other interesting facts, and it did kind of reaffirm, I think, probably the widely held belief that higher intelligence, if not leads to, at least corresponds with atheism. And a study that was released in February in the UK discovered that teenagers with a higher intelligence were more likely to be atheists than not. And this, I think, was collaborated or by scientist Todd Shackelford, who was in evolutionary psychology at Florida Atlantic University, who reviewed 40 studies on religious and intelligence going back over 100 years. And he says all but two of them suggested that more educated people tended to be less religious. So I guess reaffirming some already commonly held beliefs in that regard. Interesting, though, that there appears to be no real biological footprint of religious belief or atheist mentality in the brain.
Well, yeah. It'd still be interesting to see some more research, because, I don't know, somehow there does... It's one of those things, it's like there's an intuitive sense that there might be something different, because why do some people believe so strongly?
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, there's maybe it's not so much that there's a difference in the average religious brain, but maybe it's like any other form of mental illness, if I could be so bold as to say that. extremist case can be different, but anyhow.
Yeah. It also makes you wonder, like, you know, why somebody who's brought up in an extremely religious environment might turn out to be an atheist.
Yeah. That makes sense. You know, but there still is some, well... The religion still has very interesting aspects for our lives right now. I was reading a study that was studying the Last Supper. Now, for those of you who may or may not know, but one of the iconic images of the church and art history itself is a painting of the Last Supper, where Jesus is with his 12 disciples and they're having the breaking of bread.
And one of them is Mary Magdalene, and there's a knife in it, and yeah. In the background you see Dan Brown waving or something.
Yeah, if you look at it closely, no, but there is actually apparently a real message that you can get from these, and not just ones you find in the Da Vinci Code, which Ethan's making reference to. A couple of brothers, Brian and Craig Wansink, that's it. One of them is a food scientist, the other is a religious studies. And apparently they were talking one day about stuff, and the topic of portion size came up, and how, you know, there's supposedly an epidemic in the United States of obesity, and how did we get, you know, is this a unique thing? Has it been growing over time? So they got the idea of looking at the Last Supper, and they looked at 52 paintings of the Last Supper, well-known paintings, dating back over the last 1,000 years. And they indexed the sizes of food in the items, and they used head sizes as sort of the standard. So the head was 1, and then everything else was in relationship to the head. And they found that over the years, at a notable rate, the size of the main course increased up to about 70%, sizes of bread increased by about 25% over time. And you can see how there's like a cultural shift over the last 1,000 years to bigger and bigger portion sizes, which I thought was interesting. And I thought, what a unique way to get this interesting data by looking at paintings over time.
That is very interesting. I have to wonder about that. I mean, early on, I imagine that large portion sizes were pretty rare for, unless you're, you know, the upper nobility. But as time progressed and food became more readily available, I suppose the average portion size for the average person got bigger and bigger, and art reflected that.
You would think that, but actually, see, there you hit on the last thing, art. Who paid for art 1,000 years ago? Well, it was the rich nobility. So even relative to them, their portion size increased as well. So it wasn't even so much necessarily that food sizes increased for all the classes, but at least for the people who could afford paintings.
Yeah, definitely.
They would have been there, which I think is quite interesting. I wonder, of course, if people are going to be doing similar studies of our movies, you know, 1,000 years from now, watching the portion sizes or something of dinners and movies. I know when I watch old films, one of the things I find fascinating is looking on the back of it where they have like restaurants and they have the price, you know, pie, 5 cents, ice cream, 10 cents, you know, go, wow, that's cheap, you know.
Well, you probably couldn't notice things like that. I mean, I suppose if you switch from, say, food to other things like, you know, blatant sexuality, violence, you know, common swearing,
smoking and drinking,
yep, drug use, anything like that. Yeah. Interesting. That's really fascinating. Well, let's shift gears to the UK, I guess, sort of again, and talk about ClimateGate, my most hated of all gates. It turns out, I'm sure everybody remembers, back in the UK, somebody hacked into, what was it, the East Anglian University database and stole some emails that made it look like scientists there were fraudulently and knowingly perpetuating the climate change hoax.
To be fair, they picked and choosed comments out of these emails.
Yeah.
And claimed that they were trying to discredit annoying requests from climate change deniers.
Right. Well, it prompted some reviews into the university. And the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee said Wednesday that they see no evidence to support charges that the University of East Anglia's Climate Research Unit or its director, Phil Jones, had tampered with data or perverted the peer review process to exaggerate the threat of global warming. So they are exonerated by this investigation.
But of course, you know, the climate change deniers are still going to come up and use this. In fact, I was listening to an interesting research thing about weathermen, you know, people who give you the weather on TV. And apparently, in a study done recently, and I don't have the data on this because I wasn't expecting to talk about it, but half of news reporters of weather don't actually believe in climate change, and only 1/3 believe that climate change is man-induced. And which goes very much against the scientific evidence. But these are the people who actually give you the weather. And in the same report, they said that I think it's up to 60% of people trust their weatherman more on this than they do any other particular source. And I was just wondering, I mean, where would you get the disconnect between that? Because I mean, meteorologists, they're not science scientists, but they are science-based people.
Yeah. I wonder if perhaps a lot of weather reporters are not actually scientists, but are rather just, you know, really good in front of the camera. Like David Letterman used to give the weather on the news. I'm sure he wasn't a meteorologist.
That's true. And also, too, I mean, everyone says that there's, you know, editorial interference from the corporate, quote-unquote,
right,
heads. And if you're actually on the floor in a studio, like a news studio, maybe you would be, if not actually influenced by, influenced by the climate of the studio itself.
Yeah, it's all around possible.
I was rather actually disappointed that they didn't actually say what they thought the cause or the reason for this change. But thinking of change, another thing, which for those people who believe in freedom of science, there is an interesting court case in the U.S. South District Court of New York, which ruled against Myriad, it's a biochemical company, for a genetic test. Apparently they have a test where they can tell if you have this particular gene, you are significantly more likely to get breast cancer. I think it's breast cancer. And they have a patent on this gene. So if you want to get the test to find out whether you have this or not, you have to pay them a license fee, which is several thousand dollars. And no one is allowed to test for this gene, at least in the United States, without getting patent permission. And the court said, no, that's ridiculous. You can't patent genes. Genes are a natural creation, and it's against, which goes against a lot of court cases which have said that companies can patent genes. Now, this isn't quite as good as some people might think, because one of the reasoning he came about it was it is just the gene. Now, a lot of the patents for genetic things are things to produce things. So you have a bacteria that produce a latex thing or whatever. And because they're actually making something, they're not sure whether this court case will continue on to those. And of course, Myriad Genetics, the company that lost the case, is going to appeal this court case. But it was really weird because, you know, what's one of the things that we've talked about this on the show before? If you get a medical diagnosis from a doctor, what do you do if you don't really, you know, you're not sure? Is you get a second opinion. Well, in the United States, you could not get a second opinion. There was only the one place to go, and to go anywhere else would have been a crime or leaving the jurisdiction. I mean, patents are locally enforced. So
that is very strange. I think it does raise some interesting questions about, I guess, patenting science, but also going further than that, you know, protecting the intellectual advancements of, say, one drug company over the other. Suppose you have drug company A produces, you know, a cure for disease X. Are they obligated to share their intellectual creation with drug company B?
Well, and I don't know how many people remember, but one of the big movements in the 90s was the whole Human Genome Project, which was the whole idea was to create the genome, map it out, and have it available for scientists and for everyone who wants it. I mean, I don't think I would have a big problem with this company if it had a proprietary way of finding this gene, like if it wasn't the gene itself, but the method of finding it, or again, some extra thing. But the idea that you can own a gene just somehow seems in itself, especially the human genome. You know, I mean, it's a part of you. It's part of all of us.
And right.
Seems, and billions of dollars were spent to try and make it public property.
Well, very fascinating conversation. Let's go to a commercial break. And when we come back, we'll hear from our pal Rob, who's off skiing and sushiing and swishing and stuff like that.
Do people feel like making some noise tonight?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, Cookie Monster's favorite radio station.
Good night, Chicago! Brutal!
Dispatches from a Skeptical Traveler. This past weekend, people all over the world celebrated the beginning of spring in a variety of ways. My own family, being Polish and raised Roman Catholic, participated in a particularly strange ritual. Every year at Easter, the Polish community of Vancouver comes together at St. Casimir's Church in Burnaby. Inside, the church is decked out with a life-size diorama depicting Jesus' corpse in the cave from which, the story goes, he rose from the dead 3 days after being interred. Now, the weirdness of a religion based on worshipping what is essentially a zombie aside, note the theme of life after death. It's not a coincidence that Easter happens at the start of spring. Christianity likes to think it's celebrating the miracle of the resurrection, but they're pretty much just celebrating the renewal of life that comes around this time every year, like pretty much every other religion. Nowhere is this more obvious than with the ritual particular, as far as I know, to the Polish Catholics. Beside the church, Polish families line up outside the doors of the Christian school gym, decked out in their Sunday best and carrying baskets full of colorful Easter eggs, cured meats, and loaves baked in the shape of lambs. Every 15 minutes, a new batch files inside, the doors close, and the magic happens. The priest says a few things which roughly translate to, "God, you're so cool and powerful. Can you bless these eggs? Thanks, and please forgive us because we're guilty for everything." The priest then sprinkles the eggs in the audience with some holy water, using a ceremonial metal wand called an aspergillum. Pretty standard stuff. Only, this isn't a Catholic thing. This is a pagan ritual that the ancient Poles used to do as a fertility rite for the beginning of spring. The priest sprinkles special water from his magic wand onto the eggs. I think you see where this is going. Note that he also goes for the audience with the sprinkling. Anyways, the Christians came to Poland, saw that the people did this, and were like, "Yeah, we do that too, sure." This appropriation of local rites into Christianity in order to convince the natives to join up isn't new. Just look up the origins of Christmas traditions. It turns out that Roman Catholicism isn't special. It's just popular. Older, smaller sects of the world's religions carry on their original practices, and the big new ones take all the credit. But really, we all know it's just a big springtime sex party. Think about that the next time you unwrap a chocolate egg.
Tune in next week for another Dispatch from a Skeptical Traveler.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Thanks, Rob. That was most interesting.
Yes, I don't know if I can touch an egg again.
Well, why don't we go to our interview? Again, we had this last week, but the internet web gods interfered and destroyed our podcast, so we're going to re-air it. It's an interview with one of the organizers of Skeptic Camp, which happened two or three weeks ago here in Vancouver. I can't remember when. It was really fun, and we gave some talks there. I hope you all either saw it or heard about it from somebody, and listen to this interview and get some more information about Skeptic Camp.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. We're here with Melanie Fulgham, who was the chief organizer for Skeptic Camp 2010 here in Vancouver. Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you were the primary organizer of Skeptic Camp. Is it true what they say about skeptics and cats?
Well, in general, maybe yes, but I think for Skeptic Camp, we did pretty good. We had a lot of people that wanted to help out. So generally, it is hard to herd skeptics, but for Skeptic Camp, I think we did pretty good. We had a lot of people that wanted to help out and help organize. We had a big team compared to last year, and so it actually went okay.
Well, that's pretty good. And so for people who don't know, what makes Skeptic Camp different from other conferences?
So Skeptic Camp is in the unconference format. So the idea is that it's organic, sort of everybody participates. Instead of coming to just watch some expert speak on a topic, everybody's invited to speak or participate or ask questions or help organize. And so it's a little bit different than a normal conference.
And it occurred on the 20th, for our listeners who don't know. Having some time to digest it all, how do you think it went?
I think it went really well. We had 18 speakers in one day, which was maybe a lot, maybe too many, but we got through them all and we only went a half hour over the time. We had about 75 people in at the peak, and we were hoping for a few more, but 75 still is a great turnout, and we had a wonderful variety of speakers.
Well, so what was your favorite talk then?
Oh, that's tough. I think my favorite was Jerry Armstrong, who was an ex-Scientologist. He joined Scientology at a very young age, a former Sea Org member who wanted to write a biography on L. Ron Hubbard and became very disillusioned with the whole organization when he started to realize that L. Ron Hubbard was saying some very fraudulent things about his military background and some other things. And when he tried to leave the Church of Scientology, they came after him. And his talk was really interesting, really inspiring, and kind of scary, actually, when he talked about death threats he'd received and living in hiding. But it was just fascinating.
I remember how he kind of compared Scientology to the mob, except that Scientology figured out how to get charity status as a religion, which was a little frightening, I suppose, wasn't it?
Right, exactly.
So I guess Skeptic Camp then is not really only about, say, science, but other aspects of skepticism and critical thinking. What kind of topics in general do you look for a Skeptic Camp talk?
Well, there's no right answer to that. You know, skepticism and critical thinking doesn't just mean science. It's certainly, science is a part of that, because science is the process that critical thinkers use to sort of discover what is true and what is not true. But you can still apply critical thinking to pretty much any area of your life. And that's one of the great things about Skeptic Camp. You know, normally when you're going to a science lecture, you sort of have an idea of what science is, and you maybe go to a lecture on physics or chemistry. But when you come to Skeptic Camp, people have their own ideas of how they use skepticism in their own life, and they come at it from different angles. So, you know, we had a talk from a journalist, which was really interesting. We had a talk from a personal trainer who uses skepticism in his sort of personal training philosophy. So, you know, any time that you're applying critical thought, that's a skeptical topic.
Excellent. So what's next for Skepticamp?
So because we had a really great turnout and we've been on a roll for the past 3 years, my first Skepticamp in Vancouver was last year, and that was the second one in the row, and the one we just held in March was the third one. So we've decided to try for another one this year in October, and we're going to try for October 23rd. And so that date has a couple significant things about it. One, it's close to Halloween, and so there's a lot of sort of skeptical topics that are related to Halloween, like ghosts and vampires and things that we can talk about. But also, 1023 is related to Avogadro's number, which is a number that we often talk about when we're talking about homeopathy. And so, recently around the world, there was some homeopathy protests to sort of bring awareness to what homeopathy is, or maybe more aptly, what it isn't, which is it's water with essentially nothing in it, or very small amounts of, ingredients in it. And so we're hoping to use 1023 as another day to bring awareness to homeopathy. So all of those things plus Skepticamp, it's going to be great.
Awesome. I guess you kind of hinted on some things there, but do you have any topics or presenters lined up that you could let us in on the secret right now?
I don't think that I want to give away too much, but we do already have some speakers lined up because we didn't fit everybody into the March 20th event. We actually had more speakers than we could fit into the day. So we've already got a good start on the list of people.
Excellent. Excellent. And so what can people do to help? I helped organize with this with a number of other great skeptics in Vancouver. And so, what were the things that you think we could add to that process in terms of volunteers or promotion? What are we looking for people?
Well, I mean, the first thing is spread the word. We certainly had a room where we could have held more people, even though we had a great crowd. There was room for more. And so, in October, we hope to get an even bigger crowd. So if you're interested in Skepticamp, tell a friend about Skepticamp. Maybe tell somebody that doesn't identify themselves as a skeptic, but you think might be interested in the conference and sort of has a critical mind, or maybe somebody who doesn't that you think might get some enlightenment from the conference. Putting up posters is a great thing. We had a lot of people contact us from different universities and different places, and they helped us put up posters. We really, want people to ask questions when they're there. There's lots of things.
Oh, excellent. And all these people with great ideas, how can they get in touch with Skepticamp and figure out all their great ideas and help implement them?
So you can check out the website at vancouver.skepticamp.org, and you can check there for updates. And when we start the registration process for October, everything's going to be there. If you want to give feedback on the last conference, if you were there, or just send some ideas for the upcoming conference, you can email me at vancouverskepticamp@gmail.com. And that email, I always check that, and we're using that to sort of gather up the suggestions for this next one, and that's the best way to do it.
Awesome. Well, I know that we've gotten a bit of feedback here at Radio Free Thinker about Skepticamp. Everybody seemed to really enjoy it. They really liked the non-conference format where they got to ask questions and interact with the speakers, so I think it was a great success, and I hope to see a lot more people in October, and hopefully some people in costume, because I think that'd be really good as well. Some vampires, goblins, or homeopathy salesmen, something really scary like that.
Yeah, very good idea. And there might even be some prizes related to that. So.
Oh, prizes. Excellent.
So start building your costumes now.
And I should remind people that if you haven't, you should try to get your hands on a Skepticamp t-shirt. They are very awesome, and they have the Radio Free Thinker logo on the back.
That's true. And so we might be bringing out those t-shirts at some of the events over the summer from the various sort of skeptical organizations. So Skeptics in the Pub is one that you can check out. You guys have, I'm sure, have mentioned it on the show before.
Anytime.
You can find that on Facebook. And there's also the Center for Inquiry. They do a lot of events. We may be bringing some t-shirts to sell there as well. So keep an eye on that. And otherwise, you can keep an eye on the Vancouver Skepticamp website.
Excellent. Well, Melanie, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and thanks for Skepticamp, and best luck planning it.
Great. Thanks, Ethan.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I get high with a little help from my friend. Gonna try with a little help from my friend.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker on CITR. So we're doing a bit of a recap from last week, and one thing we want to recap is an email that we got, because it was a very good email. So why don't I just recap that email right now? This email comes from Ryan, and he writes, Radio Free Thinker. I've been hearing a lot about Ann Coulter's speech, or cancellation of her planned speech, on the news and such. Anyway, I remember a few weeks ago, one of you guys, Don, I think, did a talk about free speech in Canada. I was wondering what you guys at Radio Free Thinker have to say about the whole affair and its consequences for Anne and free speech in Canada. Also, unlike other controversial speakers and groups, Coulter got an email from the University of Ottawa warning her of legal implications of hate speech in Canada because it's different from the US. Do you guys think this was warranted considering the nature of a lot of her past speeches?
Well, you know, seeing as I did do the talk on free speech, it brings up several different layers of information. I mean, in the one sense, you know, legally, does Ann Coulter have the right to speak in Canada? And I think most of us would agree, yes, she does, even though what she says may not be what we all like to hear say. Conversely, of course, those people who don't want her to speak also have a right of free speech. They can sit there and say, hey, listen, we don't want her here, and they can say it quite vehemently as well, provided they don't break the law. Of course, socially, which is where the protesters come into it, free speech is quite often limited in social context. I mean, Ann Coulter is by far one of the more polarizing individuals out there. I mean, she's said, and I shall quote, that the United States should engage in torture. It should be a televised spectator sport. She said in another instance that that we should invade their countries, kill their leader, and convert them to Christianity. I'm paraphrasing that one.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, she is a decisive person. But the other issue that came up with this was the letter that was given warning her about free speech in Canada. And some people have taken this as sort of a threat. But again, because in Canada we have hate speech crimes, it is illegal to say some things that are considered to be hate crimes that don't exist in the United States. And I think, you know, really, that's that was a valid thing for them to say, listen, come here, do your speech, but be aware, our laws are different here than they are somewhere else.
Right.
And I think an equivalent would be if I went to Saudi Arabia, and I'm known as a boozer on stage, and Saudi Arabia has very strict laws about alcohol use. And if they said, you know, come to here, but beware, we have very strict laws about alcohol, I'd go, thank you. I'm glad you told me that, because I might have to edit my act to not include drinking or an ankle.
Right.
You know, the funny thing is there's a lot of hypocrisy about this, too, because Ann Coulter's also quoted in saying that, where was it here, about free speech, that, I've lost my quote now. What do you think of it, Ethan?
Well, see, I think there's actually kind of two questions here. One of them is basically asking, you know, what is our opinion on free speech? And for that, I mean, really, it's very difficult to give an answer and frame it skeptically. You know, my opinion is that hate speech is a real thing. It happens. And in a worst-case scenario, it can lead to violence that we might characterize as a hate crime. So I think freedom of speech is both very important, and I stand by the notion that people should have the freedom to voice their ideas. I've said before, though, I don't think you should be able to avoid the consequences of your speech. And I think that's kind of what the situation is about. Ann Coulter has a history of saying inflammatory things that are based on nothing but her, well, hate of people who are different from her.
Well, yeah, and she's quoted as saying that all terrorists are Muslim.
Yeah. I mean, like, again, that's just... It's wrong. I mean, you can't defend that in terms of, okay, well, maybe she's kind of right. No, it's not. She's just wrong.
Right.
And again, like, her talks are motivated by her own prejudice. So, I mean, I think she's perfectly within her rights to voice those prejudice, but she's not free to escape consequences. If somebody, you know, wants to boo her or protest her talks, that's perfectly within their right. And she provoked them to do so. So I don't see what the problem is.
Well, you know, and I found that quote, because here's Ann Coulter's own idea of free speech. This is from a University of Florida speech in October 20, 2005. She said, "They're always accusing us of repressing their speech. I say, let's do it. Let's suppress them. Frankly, I'm not a big fan of the First Amendment." This is Ann Coulter. I think, though, there's another issue that comes upon this that actually I found quite disturbing in the Kadeem thing, is how a certain group of people who have latched onto this issue and have said, you know, we need to defend free speech rights no matter what. And they're making it a huge issue about free speech, irrespective of the fact that never really came into it. There was an article I was reading in the Western Standard that was saying that, you know, we should let free speech is an absolute, everyone deserves it, no matter what they have to say. And two, that, what's the word I'm looking for here? That, well, I've lost my train of thought again. Damn, that's nice.
Yeah, I think it's because Rob and Daniel sort of keep us grounded. But, you know, yeah, I think that the real question here is not free speech. Free speech is not in danger in Canada. The issue here is, you know, where do we draw the line? Essentially, do we want a society where anything goes? And I think for some people, yeah, I mean, that's what they want. That's the definition of free speech. And I think to a certain degree, we have that right now. The only caveat to that is that we put a bit of responsibility on people making their free speech.
Exactly. You know, and I finally remember what I was going to add to that is they also pointed that by making an issue of this, by protesting Ann Coulter, we're giving her publicity, we're shining a light on her in a sense that maybe is not good if you don't agree with her opinion. But I think that's wrong too. In the Supreme Court cases against Keekstra and another guy, they said that, you know, sometimes exposing bad ideas, bad hate speech, is a good thing, that you should do that. So protesting her too. I mean, there's the hypocrisy there that I find that some people have had in there, that they want Anne to have the freedom to give her speech, but they don't want people to have the freedom to protest her speech, which I found one of the disturbing themes that came up. The ad issue on The National came up with the same thing. They said, you know, well, these people shouldn't be protesting. It's bad they're protesting because she should have free speech. Well, what about their free speech, you know?
Right. It's a thorny issue. And again, you know, we're not going to solve this issue in the 5 minutes we've been talking about it. And nor can we really expect people to come around to our way of thinking on this. I mean, it's a lot of it is opinion, and a lot of it, I think, is just sort of, you know, your own personal take on the laws and are hate speech laws needed or not. But again, thank you for the email, Ryan. We really appreciate that. And we encourage you, if you have a question or comment or really anything you want to discuss, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
On that note, a person has questioned me about, you know, how can our listeners promote skepticism? What do you guys think of that idea? How do you guys promote skepticism? Have you ever converted a friend to skepticism or something? If you have, again, send us an email. Let us know your story. Let us know your questions to radio.freethinker@gmail.com. That's radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Thanks for clarifying that. That really confusing me. Well, why don't we move on to, I think, our big topic, the topic that we were all so excited to do last week, unfortunately, just didn't make it to the podcast. And that is a discussion about the Catholic Church, I think largely rotating around the notion of, is the Pope a criminal? So I'm sure everybody by now has heard about all the allegations that have come forward and all the articles that have been published regards to the Catholic Church and its abuse of children in its care. Now, I'm going to sort of summarize some of these articles and items that have been appearing in the news for our listeners. You probably heard about a New York Times article in which the Pope apologized for abuse in Ireland. He offered no consequences, however, to the abusers. And what this is relating to is four Irish Catholic archbishops who ignored sexual abuse of children from 1975 to 2004. In fact, a report from the Irish authorities implicated that the sexual abuse in Ireland has been ongoing for a very long time. One priest admitted to sexually abusing over 100 children and over a 25-year career in the church. The commission by Irish authorities examined complaints of over 320 children against 46 priests. I think that alone should give you pause. I mean, this is a pretty systematic problem here we're dealing with. Of the 46 priests examined, 11 pleaded guilty and were convicted in criminal courts of sexual assault of children. Now, the Cardinal Sean Brady, who was the head of the Irish Catholic Church, who oversaw the initial cover-up of the abuse and protection of child molesters in 1975, he offered to resign if the Pope requested him to. And the Pope has since not requested. Now, Bishop John Magee, who was under the direct authority of Cardinal Brady, he has resigned over his failure to stop child sexual abuse in his diocese. Now, Cardinal Brady took the time to stress that, quote, he wanted to acknowledge Bishop Magee's long and varied ministry and, quote, I assure him of my prayers at this time and wish him good health in his retirement. I guess he feels that prayer is better than criminal charges for his years of looking the other way while children were raped. Now, the Pope has apologized to Ireland and Ireland alone. He did not request Cardinal Brady to resign. He did not mention any punishment for the priests who committed or covered up the sexual assault of children. And, well, frankly, many are just confused as to why these rapists were not reported to local civic authorities. So, I mean, that's a good question. Like, why? Why were convicted and self-admitted rapists not handed over to the local authorities?
Well, I think it's obvious, isn't it? I mean, obviously they didn't want to damage the image of the church. And I think one of the things that goes into this is to think of the psychology involved in some of these people. It's kind of scary in a way, because if you believe in an immortal soul, right, then no matter what happens to you in this life, however horrible, is insignificant compared to that afterlife. So if some child is raped or abused and suffers a bit here, but you manage to save his soul or someone else's soul, then that is infinitely better than risking damaging the church's image and have some people condemned to hell forever. Or at least that's one of the ways that goes into this.
Right. Well, one possibility is that the Pope, the current Pope, who used to be a cardinal, was part of a council designed to handle child sexual abuse allegations. And wouldn't you know, the Pope's general strategy for doing this was covering it up and moving the suspected priest to a different diocese. Not exactly very Christian of him. Or maybe it was, who knows.
You know, one of the things, too, that came up with that is, I mean, it's not so much that Pope Benedict, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, was a soft guy, was a nice guy. It depended on what the issue was. I mean, if you were doctrinally, if you were a liberal Catholic priest, you would excommunicate. He excommunicated a priest who gave a blessing over a war protest. So if you were against church doctrine, he was a hard ass.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you were a criminal, at least in the civil sense of the term, reasonable, rational sense, he'd give you a bye.
Right.
Do you have any particular examples of that?
Well, see, okay, the first example I just gave was the Pope apologizing to Ireland. And there's really, other than the fact that he was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith that was designed to protect children, he doesn't have a direct connection to that. However, accusations have arisen in America that the Pope directly intervened and covered up childhood sexual abuse by a priest. Now, in this instance, there's a lawsuit being brought against the Vatican in America in which a priest, Lawrence C. Murphy, allegedly abused 200 deaf children. In 1996, Cardinal Ratzinger, the Pope, failed to respond to two letters from Archbishop of Milwaukee, Rembrandt G. Weakland, and basically asking the Pope, can we have a cardinal trial for this pedophile? When no one from the Vatican responded, they eventually decided to have their own secret trial, but Cardinal Ratzinger stopped the trial because Lawrence C. Murphy, the accused, wrote him a letter saying that he had repented and was old and, quote, I simply want to live out the time that I have left in the dignity of my priesthood.
I wonder if the Pope gave any consideration to the children, the victims of that priest abuse, and whether they will be able to live out the rest of their life with any form of
dignity and peace. Yeah, I don't know. Probably not. In 1993, when complaints about Father Murphy were landing on his desk, Archbishop Weakland hired a social worker specializing in treating sexual offenders to evaluate him. After 4 days of interviews, the social worker said that Father Murphy had admitted to his acts, had probably molested about 200 boys, and felt no remorse. So, again, I think that casts some very serious implications on the Pope himself, not just on, obviously, this rapist, but also the institution that the Pope was, you know, looking after.
You know, and just to show that the Catholic Church isn't above, quote-unquote, petty politics, The former Archbishop of Boston, who is also, because there was a huge scandal in Boston for the same thing, abuse of children, was one of the sponsors of the current Pope's nomination to become Pope. So part of me has to wonder, you know, was there some sort of back dealings going on? Listen, I'll keep quiet about this if you offer to support me here. It really, I can't say it lowers my opinion of the Catholic Church or churches in general, because obviously I didn't have that high opinion, but I thought it was even interesting that the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Anglican head of the Anglican Church, said that the Irish Catholic Church has lost all credibility. Of course, again, a bit more political insight. I mean, if people remember a couple of months ago, the Catholic Church, in an attempt to capitalize on a schism in the Anglican Church, said, hey, come on, become Roman Catholic. I guess it's the Anglicans getting their digs back.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny how, you know, petty religious politics can be. In the case of, you know, widespread child rape, they see this as an opportunity to score points with their members, but whatever.
You know, and I find it really, really offensive that prior to the Easter Mass that the Pope gave, the Archbishop? Cardinal Angelo Sandono, who is Dean of the Cardinal of College of Cardinals, issued a thing saying that, you know, all of this is just petty gossip and that we should remain unfailing in our support of our leadership. Something apparently that's never really been done before, the Easter Mass. This is a departure to sort of say, let's rally the troops around our leader, irregardless of what he may or may not have done.
Yeah.
You know, which of course leads up to the whole other issue. If the Catholic Church is ignoring all of this, what should we do? You know, what can the civil authorities do towards the Pope?
Well, it's a good question. Before we get to that, though, I want to go over one last case here. And again, sort of going back to the deaf children who were abused, this is a lawsuit that's being brought to light. So nothing's been proven just yet. But the New York Times ran an article indicating that Pope Benedict was actually directly responsible for protecting a pedophile priest in Europe. Now, I'm sure some of our listeners know that before he was Benedict, he was Cardinal Ratzinger, and he was a cardinal in Munich, I believe. And a memo has come to light that shows back when the Pope was in Munich, he was informed that a priest, Peter Hollermann, who he had sent to therapy in 1980 to overcome pedophilia, would be reassigned to a new parish. That priest was later convicted of molesting boys in that parish. A statement from the Archdiocese of Munich and Friesling placed full responsibility for the decision to allow the priest to return his duties on Colonel Ratzinger's deputy, the Reverend Gerhard Gruber. However, the memo clearly shows that the future Pope not only led a meeting on January 15th, 1980, approving the transfer of the priest, but was also kept informed about the priest's reassignment. Cardinal Ratzinger was later appointed to a position of handling these accusations for the Vatican, which we've mentioned already. Now, I think it's kind of imperative to examine things on a microscopic level here, looking at the weeks between December 1979 and February 1980, and take a look at just how responsible the Pope was. So, September of 1979, the accused was removed from his congregation after three sets of parents claimed he molested their children. He did not deny the charges. On December 20th of 1979, Munich's personnel chief, Father Farr, allegedly received a phone call from the Essen diocese requesting Hollermann's transfer to Munich to see a psychiatrist there. On January 9th of 1980, Farr prepared a summary of the situation for top officials of the diocese, saying that Hollermann needed medical psychotherapeutic treatment in Munich and a place to live with an understanding colleague. On January 15th of 1980, Cardinal Ratzinger presided that morning over the meeting of the Diocesan Council, and the request for Hollermann was approved. On the 20th of 1980, January, Cardinal Ratzinger's office received a copy of the memo from his vicar general returning Hollermann to full duties. Hollermann resumed parish work practically on arrival in Munich, and he was later convicted of molesting boys at another Bavarian parish. So, I mean, clearly the Pope was both in a position to stop this priest, was in a position to keep an eye on this priest, was basically in the perfect position to do something about this priest. He apparently did nothing, allowed him to return to work, and allowed him to continue molesting people. I think that that clearly speaks for itself when it says, is the Pope, you know, directly responsible for child abuse? Yes, well, he is.
Yeah, and you know, some people have said, well, maybe he was just ignorant of it. You know, wasn't he actively was involved. He was like George Bush, and everyone knows George Bush didn't.
Yeah, he was completely negligent. Like, ooh, that's so much better.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. But too, the Cardinal Ratzinger, or the Pope Benedict, was known as a micromanager. That was sort of one of his shticks. That's why the Pope John Paul appointed him to the positions he did, because he did such a good job of it. But yeah, so he's a criminal. I think if he isn't a criminal par se, he should at least be given his day in court to prove himself to be either innocent or guilty.
Yeah, I mean, he's aiding and abetting criminals. I mean, I'm sure that's breaking some law somewhere.
Well, you know, and the funny thing is that he is going to the UK later this year at a cost of over $22 million to the British taxpayer. And apparently there are some lawyers there who want to bring him up on charges. But of course, there are some problems with that, because not only is the Pope the leader of the Catholic Church, but he's also head of the Vatican City, which is nominally an independent nation. Although, in an article in Associated Press, they argue that it's not actually a member. It's not a member of the UN. It was created as an Italian creation from Mussolini, not that that's really important, but it's given the status of a nation, but it may not actually legally be a nation, which leads to the possibility that if he comes to England, if he comes to the United States, where there are these active criminal investigations going on, that he might actually be brought up on charges.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting discussion because, you know, looking at the evidence, I think it's pretty clear that the Pope is, you know, responsible for these situations. And you know, he may not get jail time. He may not be the primary target of lawmakers, but he should at least be, you know, in court giving a testimony about, you know, why did you let these priests go back to work?
Well, to give the devil his due, the Pope has not been himself directly charged with any form of pedophilia or any.
No,
sexual
everyone's
abuse or
either
like
taken
that.
The fall for him or said, you know, oh, it's his aide's fault or oh, it's his, you know, secretary's fault.
Sorry. I was meaning that he hasn't actually physically abused the children directly, although he has, as you pointed out, aided and abetted
yeah.
the whole thing.
Well, I mean, we don't know. I mean,
well,
like,
that's true. But
again, like, it's so hard to say. I mean, the institution is so built to protect its own.
You know, and there is actually now a growing movement. I mean, what was it, President Milosevic, who was charged and arrested and given war crime trials? The former president of Sierra Leone, Charles Taylor, who is also renowned for crimes against humanity. And I mean, if nothing qualifies as crimes against humanity, this must at least come close to it.
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, can the World Court put the Pope on trial? I would like to see it. I'm sure that maybe some of our listeners will have an opinion on that, and they can, you know, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. But before we wrap up, there's just sort of one other aspect of this case that I think we might want to discuss. Given if you took, say, the entire population of the Catholic Church, I'm talking about all the priests and all the nuns and all the, you know, different groups of cardinals and bishops and all of them, combine them all together. Suppose you got a number, I don't know, but let's just say it's like 3,000. If you took 3,000 ordinary people from any country, what would the ratio of child molesters be in, say, the Catholic Church and just the control? Do you think it'd be higher, lower, about the same?
Well, you would assume, I mean, outside of perhaps institutional issues, they're all humans, and I actually don't believe in a god, so I don't think there'd be any other external, so that should be about the same, wouldn't you?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, are we just talking about, you know, a few bad apples?
Or is it institutional?
Yeah. That's the question.
To throw out my two cents, I was listening to a podcast called Reasonable Doubts, where they mentioned that there is like a 3-to-1 ratio of pedophilia between non-Catholics and Catholic church leaders, and I mean, you know, so there does actually seem to be a lot more Catholic priest sex abusers out there.
Right. Well, see, the one point I want to make about this as well is that we're not really talking about the Catholic Church should be shut down because of pedophilia. We're talking about Church.
I would say that.
Okay. Well, I would say that it's not so much that some Catholic priests are pedophiles. It's that the Catholic Church protects priests who are pedophiles. You know, if you had a corporation like, I don't know, Coca-Cola, and their board of governors, you know, systematically rape children, you know, they probably would turn those guys over to the civic authorities. Whereas the Catholic Church feels that it's in its power to, you know, forgive these people and just kind of, you know, move them along to a different parish where they can continue to rape people.
Well, and let's not forget, there's a Canadian angle to all this. If anyone remembers the residential schools, which were run, I believe 60% were run by Catholic Church, just about 30% by Anglican churches. But again, there was strong abuse, both sexual and physical abuse, perpetrated by this institution and covered up by this institution.
Right. Well, it's a big issue, go ahead.
I have one final note on this, which I think is what we're going for a wrap-up. And I thought this was hilarious, that the chief exorcist of the Vatican, a Reverend Gabriel Amoth, he knows exactly what's going on. He's 85 years old, been in the post for 25 years. It's hard to believe they have an official exorcist, but I guess it is the Catholic Church. But he says the reason for all these problems is the devil is at work inside the Vatican. Yes, and his name is Pope Benedict XIV.
Well, that's one Catholic's opinion. Again, I would welcome our listeners' opinion. Please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We're running out of time, and I hope you all enjoyed today's episode, a recap of last week's. And let's go to our skeptical highlights, because we got some pretty good ones. On April 10th at 11 a.m. is CFI's first Cafe Inquiry, a monthly social gathering where we discuss various issues in an open format where everybody can contribute. The topic this week will be altruism, and will take place at the Canford Policy Room at SFU Harbor Center. Check it out. You can go to our webpage to see the notes for that. And on April 16th and 17th, CFI, the UBC Freethinkers, and Reasons to Believe will present a series of debates on the subject of God and Christianity. The first debate will be on April 16th, called Putting God to the Test, and will feature Dr. Hugh Ross, representing Reasons to Believe. Representing CFI is Dr. Rob Tarswell, a friend of the show. And this debate will take place at UBC in the Woodward Building, room number 2, at 7 p.m. The second debate on April 17th, entitled What's Right and What's Wrong with Christianity, will feature UBC freethinker Brian Lynchahan debating Hugh Ross, and that will be at the 10th Avenue Church at 7 p.m.
That's good, and I should put a skeptic warning out there for people. Apparently we're bringing infected a second time, Deepak Chopra, if I'm pronouncing that right?
I guess so.
Who was here in February, apparently is coming back again in June. I guess there are enough people in Vancouver who believe in his kind of craziness to warrant him having a second return. Ethan, you were telling me that there was an excellent debate between him and Sam Harris and Michael Shermer.
Yeah, in fact, if you go on YouTube and Google the Future of God debate, you'll bring it up. It's in 12 parts. It's an excellent debate with Michael Shermer, Sam Harris, and Deepak Chopra. I recommend our listeners check it out. Very entertaining.
Sounds good. So I guess this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying thanks for listening. And next week we will be back with a full cast on Radio Free Thinker.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien